Welcome, everyone. This is new for us, but good to see you all in person and online. This is the meeting of the Planning and Community Development Committee. I'm here with Council Members Hogarty and Quinn and Laurel. We'll jump right into the agenda. The first item tonight is a contract with True Blue Strategies for Experience Tukwila, and Brandon will lead us in that discussion.
And I'm
Okay,
going to, Brandon had another prior commitment for tonight, so I'm going to just step in. He thought this would be an item that was probably something a committee was already expecting. So before you, the item is page one of your agenda, and it's recommending approval of a contract for services with True Blue Strategies, and it's about marketing Tukwila, and they are really providing the overall work on Experience Tukwila. It's the digital marketing program, and so that is in your packet, and staff recommends True Blue. They've been doing good work the last couple years. We'd like to stay with them another year since we're building momentum. And the funding for this was already approved through committee, the first meeting that this committee had during this calendar year. And it got approved by council on January 28th. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
I'll go to Kathy. Do you have any questions?
No, just remind me again. So we saw this. I'm looking on page nine at the matrix there. These are questions that are just minor. So did we see this, or we're just seeing this now for the first time?
This is the first time you're seeing the contract, but the budget for this was in the
right.
You approved the budget for lodging tax for the cities for this year, so you would have. There would have been a reference about the Experience Tukwila program in that budget.
Okay, and this is a continuation of what they've been doing.
So correct.
I'm in favor.
Thank you. Sean?
So I'm in favor as well. And so just to kind of even go down the road that Councilmember Hogarty talked about, like this was in the slate of packages of things that we approved to go to LTAC, and the assumption is they already kind of know it's coming, and what I hear you saying is this was already pre-approved, and now it's just the contract that's before us. On the previous, or is this the a current request that has been shared with LTAC?
So it already got approved by LTAC. And the contracts, and well, the budget. The LTAC doesn't approve the contracts. They approve a budget for a program. So they've approved the budget for Experience Tukwila program already. And the council approved the budget for Experience Tukwila. But because this contract is over $40,000, then it's why this is coming back.
Thank you.
Sure.
My question is, I just want clarification around the amount, because there was language in here about increasing the amount in order to receive any grants that come in. But my understanding is the council approved 130, but not 160, but we're saying 160 in case we receive grant funding. Oh, did they go away?
No.
Oh, okay. So could you explain that?
Yes. So the budget that the council approved for Experience Tukwila is the $130,000. So, but as you noted, this contract is requesting $160,000, which is more. So that's a very logical question. And the answer is, we never always know everything that might come later on in the year. There could be some other kinds of grant revenue that come in. And as an example, usually every year, the Port of Seattle has a grant opportunity. The Tukwila applies for it, gets a grant. And so sometimes we would use like that grant money to do something around marketing. And so what we're just doing is we're having this contract be larger than the current budget, but we would only spend it if some other revenue came in for doing that. And we don't have any plans to do that right now, but it's just saving us a step in the future from having to amend the contract if that came up.
Is that typical to what we do in other instances? Like, have we done that before?
I would need to give that some thought. I think in some cases, like an example would be, in my case, I've done before, is on legal services. So for instance, we have a contract for legal services with an outside attorney that had helped us on some very real estate specific work for Tukwila Village over the last few years. And so each year I do a $20,000 contract basically to have him on retainer. And so, but I don't actually know exactly whether we would even use him during the year or not. But that way, when a legal question comes up, we could have that contract in place and go out to him. So and that would be a smaller example of this, where we have a contract that's larger than what a budget for a particular program is or a particular project, so that we don't have to amend the contract. We can move a little bit more efficiently later in the year if something comes up. So, but I don't know of any bigger examples than that.
I mean, personally, I'm fine with it, just process-wise. You know, I want to make sure that the amount that we approved as a council is the amount that's going to be spent. Like, I don't want later for the 160 to be used and we didn't receive a grant, if that makes sense. Like, so if it's like somewhere written in the notes from the meeting that just says, like, you know, the additional 30K will only be spent if it's related to a grant because it was approved for 130, just making it really clear down the line. Because I'm okay with it. It's just like procedurally, I was like, this is a little iffy if we don't clarify that.
And I would say we could say grant or some other budget. So an example might be ARPA funds. So for instance, it could be later in the year. There could be a project might come up where we thought we should use some ARPA funds to help some businesses do some marketing. And let's hire True Blue to help us create some of that marketing collateral for those businesses. And that would be where there would be new budget coming in from ARPA, but it's not under the lodging tax budget. So I think the first thing is, just because the contract is higher does not authorize us to spend more than what was budgeted. And that happens in all cases. So just because a contract is approved for something does not give us the authority to go over a budget amount. And that's the first line of protection in this case you're talking about, is the lodging tax budget's 130. And so for lodging tax dollars, we have to stay to that. We would have to find other budget money in order to go above that. It could be a grant. It could be ARPA or some other funding source to come about.
Okay.
So just as a follow-up to that, I think we should be explicit in the language that, you know, we won't spend it if there isn't other sources identified. And then what I would say is, you know, just like you articulated, because the next question is, what would you say to the LTAC that approved 130 of what this is going for? So I think being very explicit around the additional 30,000 and the mitigating circumstances in which that is going to be spent. So it's clear, even just for our interface with LTAC, that when we ask for something, there might be, you know, you might not be privy to the sources that we have to pull from or whatever, but just kind of a consistency on, we're asking for 30 more because we could see other uses that may come up in the process, and that our goal is usually to ask for what we need, and then if it's more, then we supplement it with something else on an existing contract. So I think being that explicit, then it not only saves, you know, committee members in this meeting, but the council in the broader meeting, so they don't have to ask the question or wonder why. And so sometimes I always say this is like, it's a good thing to show our work.
I agree. So the action here is to for this to go to the 321 consent agenda. I'm okay with that. Kathy's nodding. Michonne? Yep. Okay.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay, thank you.
The next item on the agenda is a resolution updating land use fees. We have Max speaking to that. Hi, Max.
Hi there.
All right, floor is yours.
Great, thank you. Max Baker, Development Supervisor for the Department of Community Development. Relatively straightforward fee resolution to update the original fee resolution that set the fees for 2022. Since the original fee resolution came about in 2020, there have been a number of changes to our land use code, the wireless facilities, shoreline, critical areas, and the like. And we've made a few changes where we've amended our fees resolution and added some of those tree permits and landscape permits, but we have not updated our wireless fees since Chapter 1858, which is our wireless chapter of the zoning code, was updated this past year. And we also realized that there were a number of fees for 2022 that were either a little bit mislabeled or the fees themselves were not accurate of the amount of work that's put into the type of fee. So we proposed a few small changes to the fees resolution, and I'll share my screen here real quick and can walk you through, but they are relatively simple. So hopefully it won't take too long.
Can I pause you just for a second? I just realized that somebody's hand is up.
Oh.
Just wanted to check.
That's Vanessa Zapato.
Vanessa, did you have a question before about the previous issue? Or I'm sorry, I didn't catch your hand earlier.
Yeah, no, it was regarding this. I just wanted to make sure that if you would be willing to accept comments from the public, that I was, you know, wanting to indicate I would like to speak.
Okay, to this item that we're addressing right now, or the previous one?
Yeah, the permit fees, correct.
Permit fees. Okay, thank you. I got you, and I'll have Max finish his presentation. I'll take your comment, and then we'll go to the council members' questions. Does that sound good?
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, go ahead, Max. Thanks.
So I'll just share my screen here. So what we're seeing here is the fees resolution ordinance that was adopted in 2020. Resolution that was adopted in 2020. A couple simple changes, changing from section to chapter. When we're referring to a section like this, 1872, it should actually be chapter, and we made those changes throughout here. For the tree permits, we made a few changes to more accurately reflect what's in our critical areas, our shoreline, our landscaping, and our tree chapters of the zoning code. And so we've updated it to be a single family dwelling residential tree permit, which would keep the same price fee of $124, which was what was set for the original label tree permit for single family residential properties. And then we amended the one tree permit and landscape modification to just be landscape modification permit. Also didn't change the fees for those. And then we added two more. One is for critical areas tree permit, and the other is for shoreline tree permit. So essentially what this allows is for us to go through a proposed tree removal or tree replacement on a property, and we can kind of ask was it a residential or commercial property? And that will dictate whether or not it's a single family or landscape modification permit. And then we go on to the next one to say, oh, is it within a critical area or is it within a shoreline? And then if it's one of those, then we'd actually be applying the critical area or the shoreline instead of the landscape modification or the single family tree permit. And that just allows us to essentially streamline our review and make it a little bit easier for applicants to understand which type of tree permit they should be applying.
You want to ask? I want to ask something specific about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the critical areas tree permit, where was that before? It was up in the 121?
We actually didn't have it since the critical areas code was updated in the last couple of years. We didn't have a critical areas tree permit in our fees resolution from 2020. And we realized that we needed critical area tree removal requires more work from staff. So there's review of the tree removal and replacement, making sure you have the right types of species chosen. And then there's the monitoring period that goes along with the replacement of critical area trees. And so it was really in the next tier. It wasn't qualifying to be reviewed under the tree permit for single family residential, even though we made a reference to it here. We said including shoreline and critical areas tree permits. We were probably spending, you know, I would say at least 3 to 4 times as much time doing our critical areas tree permits than we were the typical single family residential tree permit review. So we wanted to pull this shoreline and critical areas tree permit out of the tree permit for single family residential properties because they really are three different things at this point.
Okay, so if a single family dwelling has a critical area in because it's grandfathered in or whatever reason, do they have to pay this amount? Or if they're on the shoreline, do they have to pay this amount for a tree
That's
permit?
That's right. So that would apply to all types of properties across the city, commercial, industrial, residential, institutional, because essentially the way that the critical areas, the shoreline chapters are written is that the retention of trees in these sensitive areas should be promoted, and they really work differently than the single family tree, which you can remove a certain number of trees within a 3-year period, and when that 3-year period's over, you're then able to start over and remove more trees. So those, that kind of qualifying timeline doesn't apply to critical areas or shoreline trees the same way.
So you're saying that a single family would have to pay $685 for a tree permit, depending on where the tree is?
Within, if it's within a critical area, and to just kind of qualify what that means, critical areas would be wetlands and wetland buffers, streams and stream buffers, and then steep slopes.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. How about, Max, you finish your presentation. He'll finish his presentation.
And go back.
Take the question, and then we could go back to the question.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So then the next section that we were updating was essentially to reflect the updates to Chapter 1858. So we have eligible facilities modification, replacing what was Type 1 minor substantial change, replacing what was Type 2 administrative, and then new macro facility, replacing what was Type 3 major or height waiver, and the fees in the original fee resolution would still apply. This language just reflects the updates to the FCC guided updates to Chapter 1858. And then finally, just a couple edits, but with the zoning verification letter, what we were finding is that we were spending a lot of time doing large zoning verification letter reviews. So this $407, what that covers is essentially the plans reviewer pulls all the certificates of occupancy on a given parcel, pulls the parcel activity reports, which includes all development permits, code enforcement issues, and everything from the, as far back as our records go, at least up until annexation. And then we write a letter essentially saying what uses are on the property. We pull King County Assessor's information and we include it in the zoning verification letter. But we didn't have a cap for how many parcels, contiguous parcels, qualify under the zoning verification letter. So what we were finding is sometimes, you know, we get one or two inquiries, or one or two parcels in an inquiry, but in some cases there might be a large swath of land, 10 parcels or more, where people are looking to get zoning verification information for each parcel. So that meant running a query for every parcel, and it added a lot of time to the staff's review for a single zoning verification letter. So we recommended essentially sort of capping it at two parcels contiguous for this $407 fee, and then for each additional parcel to be added to that, we would add a $50 fee. That would cover the staff's time to pull those additional parcel activity reports and certificates of occupancy, as well as add information to the letter that we're writing. And that's about it.
Thank you. So we'll take the question or the comment from Vanessa.
Good evening, committee members. We greatly appreciate your taking our comments this evening. And the Director of Community Development, Nora, actually suggested that I attend this meeting this evening and share our experiences, observations, suggestions with this committee at this meeting where the permit fee adjustments are going to be presented. So we would like to bring up for a consideration of adjusting the noise variance permit fees to today's discussion. So we had a recent experience whereby a City of Tukwila staff member was questioned by a hearing examiner during a hearing as to the necessity of proceeding with a 5-year type 3 noise variance requested by Sound Transit versus the customary procedure of a typical type 1 and 2 variances, which are for up to 30 and between 30 and 60 days respectively. So when questioned, the immediate response by the staff member of the City of Tukwila was that type 1 and 2 noise variances were a strain on city resources, and only having to manage a single variance for a 5-year period would be less of a burden. So, you know, let me pause so that can sink in. Recommending a type 3 variance for noise, that's like noise that impacts the residents' well-being, has a consideration that includes city cost. And as many of you know me and our family, we are really strong advocates for controlling taxpayer costs. But what this clearly tells us is that the city is not recovering the costs for type 1 and 2 noise variances currently. And well, perhaps not for type 3 either, because that wasn't, however, clarified. But even if this was only a partial reason, the fact that the cost for the city and the burden, which we have no reason to believe that it was only a partial reason because there weren't any other reasons contributed at the hearing by city staff. But the fact is, this is a problem and one that needs to be remedied and recovered through permit fees. And this is consistent with council's previous direction for cost recovery through permit fees, and appropriate and necessary in this case, especially when we're talking about the health and safety of the residents, because it's noise, and they are considered and furthermore allows the residents the ability to more frequently and relevantly weigh in as part of the due process. So at this time of year, when adjustments are made, it's appropriate and necessary to add adjustments for this resolution for noise variance permit fees to recover those costs for the protection of our residents. Thank you.
Does the staff want to speak to that issue about, I mean, I don't think our memo today addresses that particular one, so I don't feel like I'm fully briefed yet on the issue, but, you know, maybe that's something that we could take on, look at in the future.
Yeah, so I wouldn't have the information about, it would require essentially looking at all of the type 1 and type 2 and type 3 noise variances that we've done over time and getting an idea of the amount of staff time that's spent on those and what the cost was. So, you know, these resolutions essentially look at staff hour and labor needs for these types of fees. And I think that that's something that we could discuss at a future resolution. Again, this current fees resolution only goes through 2022, so through this year. So this is just an update to the existing one using the essentially the code that we have written already. This is just reflecting what's in our existing code, and we're not proposing additional fees beyond the zoning verification letter, since that was one that we knew required a certain amount of time to recover the costs of the additional staff time for contiguous parcels. So we would need a little bit more time to essentially find out how much time we're spending on these noise variances of different types and what would be a fair fee for that type of noise variance. And it would have to be reviewed by the city attorney and the like.
Does this also happen in the process of the budgeting process? Because we are looking at like revenue recovery. I'm just thinking about, you know, when we would address it. Would that make sense? I do thank you so much, Vanessa, for coming and for raising that issue. You know, we hear you. It'll be reflected in the minutes of this meeting. And what I can tell you is that we will follow up on it when this year, as we do have to approve fees, right, for the budget, or at least look at our revenue sources.
Mm-hmm. Revenue sources.
Yeah.
Well, it's fees too.
Fees, yeah, and revenue sources. Yeah. But today, I don't think we're not prepared yet to change anything, but we will look into it. Deshaun, do you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the chair. I mean, obviously, you know, a resident came and articulated a concern and also something that was on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And what might be good in the path to figuring out, if we go down that path on the fee schedule, to have the director of DCD speak to what the policy is and the plan potentially for addressing it, but in enough time so she can assess what was said and then how it can be remedied in our process, right? Because ideally things like cost recovery, other procedural pieces, I think we would look to the director to, one, kind of tee them up and then prepare us for a broader discussion versus kind of today where, you know, we can't necessarily respond right now, but as the chair can kind of get it on a future agenda. Because in the end, when we get to the budget process, we will be approving fees, fee schedules, and other things. So that's exciting.
That makes sense to me, Nora. I see you're here. Did you have thoughts about a process to where this concern could be followed up on?
Sure. Nora Gerloff, Department of Community Development. We usually do our fees in about a two-year cycle to align with the budget process. And so we look at any major changes in that kind of first year of the cycle, and the second year just has an escalator percentage clause. So we are coming up on our cycle of having a more intensive look at what our fees are and whether they reflect the staff effort involved in the different applications. So that would be an excellent time to put this in the mix.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm gonna turn back to the presentation today that Max just gave about the land use fees and turn to my council members to see if you have any questions. The plan for this is for it to go to committee of the whole and the consent agenda after that, I guess. Is that? Yeah, committee of the whole and then consent. Kathy.
Okay, I do have some questions that could be, they could maybe be answered. It's going to go to this committee of the whole. Could be answered there.
And then consent.
So here's what they are. I'm still on page 14, where we had the single family residential tree permit, which was 121. So it's just raised a small percentage. But out of that was pulled. Now, if you're, I'm thinking specifically about residents right now. So out of that was pulled the critical areas trees and the shoreline tree permits are now 685. So they've gone for a resident from 124 to 685. It said, and it was commented that it's about four times as much work, which is ish, right? I understand that's just sort of an approximation. But still, 685 is more than four times 124. We're talking about our residents here. So a couple questions that I have are why over four times? Another one is what are those permits like in other cities? What's a tree permit cost in other cities? I was thinking about I was going to ask this for all fees, but I'm most interested in the tree permit fees in critical areas and shoreline. I understand that there is a cost recovery that's necessary. I also understand the nature of our residents. So I just have some questions about that. Everything else looks fine, but I get a red flag. That's just a lot of money for a resident. So it'd be good to have some more information to back that up.
Yes, would you like me to speak to that right now? So essentially, the chapter 1854 was updated a number of years ago, and one of the big changes to that chapter was essentially creating a three-year time period that allowed for single-family homeowners to remove a certain number of trees, or if they were really large trees, it was usually limited to one tree within a three-year period. And that was kind of the intent of the single-family tree permit, because it was a relatively quick check by staff to say, have you gone through over your three-year limit? If you haven't, we'll take that. We note it. We track your tree status for your property over those 3 years, and then essentially once that time is up, then you can go back and if you have additional trees you're looking to remove, you can remove more. The critical areas tree permits and the shoreline tree permits function much more similar to a landscape modification permit, because those have requirements for tree replacement, and they have requirements for monitoring usually over a five-year period, which involves staff going out into the field, checking for recovery of these species that have been planted. There's a landscape plan provided by the applicant. It's reviewed by the urban environmentalist. And those are our most, essentially, not our most critical trees in the city, in the sense that those are the ones that provide habitat needs for, essentially species within these sensitive areas. Especially along the shoreline, we have additional notice requirements, so we have to notify the tribe. The tribe essentially is looking to keep track of all trees that are removed within the Duwamish River shoreline area, especially because those trees are very critical to salmon habitat because they provide shade within the river area. So it's just a larger review, and we didn't want to go above the landscape modification permit, but we essentially thought that it's about the same amount of review required as a landscape modification permit.
Okay. So I didn't question the fact that a permit would be needed, but I would ask the committee if it would be okay if we asked them to give us some comparables from some other cities, because that takes a little bit of staff time, to bring that back to the committee of the whole. Another thing I'd ask the committee if they're interested in is I'd like to know, say in the last few years, however many years you want to go back, two, three, how many tree permits have been issued and just category?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so those are things, and then you just bring them back. In the interest of time and discussion, just bring them to the committee of the whole.
Yeah. I mean, as long as it's something that staff could do.
Our goal is to bring this back to the March 14th committee of the whole.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that we can pull that information time. It may be hard to find out what other cities are doing due to essentially kind of staffing issues with other cities. We have contacted about tree permits in other cities in this time before, but there's just a bit more communication lag than there used to be, and it'll take a little bit more time to kind of get a clearer understanding what other cities do as far as tree permit types and tree permit fees go, essentially because our tree permit standards are that much different than, say, Seattle or Ventnor Burien's tree permits. These were updated in just the past couple of years, and they do kind of stand alone as far as the code goes for critical areas of shoreline trees.
There's no other cities that have shoreline trees?
No, there are. But we essentially, what we've found in our kind of preliminary discussions with other planning staff is that they don't necessarily have just a tree permit process. They have something more along the lines of general shoreline code that they have to navigate, and then tree removal is a part of that, whereas we kind of pulled out tree removal as its own permit. And so we kind of have to get an idea of how much staff time those other cities and their shoreline codes are spent on tree removal and replacement and monitoring. So it's what we found in just a very quick look is that it's not as straightforward, I guess, as ours is. And that's kind of been our case too, since it was kind of buried. These tree removal, removal and replacement and monitoring requirements are kind of buried within our code, and we didn't call it out as critical areas in shoreline tree permits. And so we were getting a lot of questions of, oh, well, would this be a shoreline substantial development permit since I'm doing work within the shoreline that requires tree removal, and at what point am I needing to essentially replace and monitor these trees that I'm removing as part of the shoreline permit? So we pulled that out as a separate permit from a shoreline substantial development permit. But it would take a little bit more time. I guess the main takeaway is that I don't think I can provide necessarily a very clear answer, might not be able to provide a clear answer about the other cities' shoreline and tree permit processes, but I could look into I could easily pull the history of our own tree permit types and how many we've done over the past 2 years.
Thank you. Deshaun?
I mean, I have some of the same questions that Councilmember Hoverty has, and you know, I think the interesting thing was that I served on the tree committee that helped develop some of these things. And so I would say, as it relates to the packet, I think there's an opportunity for us to show some data along with the proposed fees. And you know, going back to what I said earlier around showing your work, right? If we're going to have this shift to 685, and we agree it's related to the shoreline permit and the critical areas permit, and we had already went through the kind of public notification, we got comments, we incorporated it. But some of this is also our consistency to what we said to ecology of how we're going to monitor these things. And so if that could provide some context as this continues to move forward. And so I would just say, I'm familiar with the TMC, but here it just looks like a strikeout with no, like, what did it say before and what will it say now? And I know we're moving one thing from the other, but I just think there's an opportunity to present this in a way of, we moved it here, as it said, here's what it says now, or here's the existing 1854, and here's the section that we're asking to be added. So I think just to kind of close the loop, like some data on why we're here, right? A reference potentially to the Shoreline Master Program or the other elements that help us get here, and why it's important to kind of pull this out on its own, because we have a commitment and a responsibility associated with, you know, anything that we say to ecology. So I was just hoping maybe some of that could show up in a packet. as a way of understanding and continuity, and then knowing there's new council members who weren't here for the shoreline process, who weren't here, who are not as familiar with ecology, and even residents as well. When we tell the state we're going to do something and how we're going to monitor it, we have a process. So I'm just wondering maybe if we can touch on those things. And I see Nora.
Nora Gerloff. I think it might be helpful to understand that generally the time when a single family homeowner would be triggering a tree permit in a shoreline or a critical area would be at a redevelopment of the site or a major expansion. We would not approve the removal of a tree in one of those areas if it weren't part of a larger development. So it's not just a neighbor thinking they're tired of a tree dropping leaves on their car or something like that.
Yeah.
That's a good piece of information.
Well, that's how I remembered it. And yet, you know, on paper and black and white, and, you know, whether or not we get attention from the public, they would ask the question, oh, are we doing this now? And so maybe it is in the very upfront area to say that this is only triggered by a large development where your minimum trees, it's almost like we're exceeding the minimum tree removal to actually get here. And the average person, single family owner, and you know this, Nora, because you were there when we went through the tree permit, there was a concern that we were passing something without communicating to the public. And what we were saying is, no, there's no, like, a super stringent, we have the same process, but we needed to be explicit around the tree permitting process.
Right. We wanted to build in quite a bit of flexibility for single family homeowners to control their own property, but it was only when we got into these environmental issues, usually around a short plat or some other type of larger redevelopment, that this would kick in.
So if we can show that up front, like maybe that'd be the first paragraph, so that people could get quickly up to speed. This is just three of us, and Kathy and I have been here. And Cynthia has been here. Kathy and I have been here from way back when. But I think the other council members who aren't either as familiar or tracking, or even how you word something in the packet, you know, I think just it's always good to pull that stuff up front. We're not proposing a new minimum standard. We're saying that this is specific to a redevelopment, and that even has some parameters on what would trigger a redevelopment.
I support that because, I mean, I'm just looking back at the info memo. It would have been nice to have, like, more context to that. I mean, we want to prepare this for committee of the whole as the best that we can. And so getting our questions out that we think other council members might ask would be helpful to get this through. Mm-hmm. Does that sound okay? Is that doable before the next?
So one of the questions I would have, since this is just that the fees residential, so the code is pretty dense as far as shoreline and critical areas code goes, along with our mitigation sequencing, our tree replacement standards, monitoring, and things like that, that there are scenarios to the director's point that it's usually in the redevelopment that we're seeing these things happen. But it could still apply, I think, in the case of something as simple as a tree wanting to be removed from the shoreline due to someone just maybe not wanting to see that tree anymore, it would still hold itself to that tree permit. And that's essentially set forth in the code as it was written in 2020. So my only question would be, it's how we approach those scenarios with a relatively dense code through just the use resolution process at this point. I don't want to necessarily try to imagine each scenario because we'd be going back to the code itself. Essentially, we're just looking to, at this point, reflect what's in the code that was approved in the last ordinance update. So that's maybe the direction that I'm wondering where we should be going with it at this point.
So I think we could certainly give some more context and some numbers behind these. I think that might be helpful information for the COW as the committee had requested. It's, you know, a quick turnaround, but we'll do our best to get that together.
What I'm hearing is more just more background information about the work that was done prior to this to make the changes. If that makes sense, like, you don't have to pull like the exact language that was changed, just to mention that this was work, like this was policy changing work that we did around the process before, and now we're just updating the fees. But I think there is more information that Councilmember Hogarty was asking for in regards to the possible impact. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, for me, it was the appropriateness of the amount of the fee. It wasn't that you shouldn't have a fee. When it was for a single family resident, and you said, well, they're redeveloping anyway. So those are good things. Maybe that should be in an info memo or something. But at the same time, somebody might have a tree that is like, they're like, this thing's dead or it's dying. I want to remove it and replace it or something. Do they have to pay $685? Those would be good things that we can ask in the COW, and you could be prepared to answer. So, and again, it was just that these are our residents. A lot of them are longtime residents, and that's a lot of money. And maybe it would be a deterrent for them to even go get a permit at all. And that's something that is realistic that we need to think about. And that's one of the reasons that I'm asking to see how many tree permits we've actually issued in the last few years.
And then including the information about how, because what I heard from you guys is that it's not just removing one tree. You can't just remove one tree, but if you redevelop your whole property, then you would, and a tree is removed in the redevelopment, then you would have to pay, but not if it was like, oh, I just want this tree gone, because they can't just do that in the critical.
Are they going to say no? So staff, I think what they're saying is they'll say, no, you can't cut your tree down.
Trees are always take a lot of time.
Trees are always,
this is always, so we don't have to have
it's
this
trees are like this.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, like, I think we've heard two answers to one question. It's not going to impact it because it only is triggered by redevelopment. And then we also heard that if somebody wants to remove a tree, and that's in the shoreline or a critical area, they may have to pay for this permit. So one, we got to be able to figure out what answer is consistent. And I think just secondly, like, you knew, what's the one question fundamentally that people would ask if this comes forward? Do I have to pay for a $685 permit? And the question is, the response is, you know, that is the information that we're going to need to provide, whether it be a resident or a council member. And so what is the answer to that question? Yes, if you're going to redevelop, maybe if you want to get rid of this tree, like I'm saying, we're hearing both responses, both answers that of it being yes.
To clarify that question, as we've been processing them currently, any tree in a critical area, any tree in a shoreline does currently require a permit, regardless of it being as part of a redevelopment or as just a removal of a tree within a sensitive area. We've been processing them under this current standard that we have, usually either as a single family tree or as a landscape modification, depending
right.
on the type.
Right. So specifically, if I can, mm-hmm. critical areas and shorelines, to remove a tree, it requires a permit.
That's correct.
Okay. So $685 could have an impact on a resident who has a tree in the shoreline or the critical area. And so what I was saying was the data behind that to show why a $685 fee is appropriate in this case. Justification in the packet that says staff time is required to do this, this, and this, which is different than a single family dwelling residential tree removal that doesn't meet the threshold of, I mean, if you've exceeded the amount of trees that you cut down, then that puts you in a criteria where you're going to have to do a permit. So I think that information is important to articulate. And some of that is also tied to our responsibilities around the critical areas and the shoreline, and some of it's related to staff time that it would take to process. And then Kathy asked a real question too, like on data, if nobody's getting them or we don't have staff to get these permits. So it's just a fundamental question of this implementing this policy that we say is on the books, but giving the justification on how we got there and why, and it is a cost recovery item, sounds like.
So let me ask, because usually we come to committee of the whole with a recommendation. It seems like the other items like that are being changed we're fine with, but we just want additional information about the tree permit before. So when we go to the committee of the whole, the recommendation is, you know, we're fine with everything, but we ask for clarification and more information around the critical areas and the shoreline.
And so Max Baker again. So I would say that the main intent for these resolution in this round was especially around our FCC updates to the wireless grid. So those minor type 1, 2, and 3 permits aren't accurate to what's in our code at this point. So if someone were to come in and do a wireless facility permit, what we have in our fees isn't reflective of what's set forth by the FCC. So that was one of the big things that really needed to happen sooner than later. The trees permit fee resolution sounds like there might be a bit more to this discussion, and I'd like to see this go along with this current fee resolution, along with the wireless fees. But it sounds like we may need to do a little bit more work as far as pulling out some of our permit history, pulling some of those sections of our shoreline and our critical areas code, and essentially kind of showing what areas maybe are residential versus commercial for shoreline and critical areas as well. Our critical area maps cover a decent amount of those critical areas in the city. They don't cover all of them. So in some cases, we might not see a critical area until someone comes to us with a proposal and the wetland's been identified on the site. And that's when we know an area is going to have critical area trees on that site. So some of those may be included with other projects. You know, they might be as part of a SEPA or a redevelopment before the tree permits started being processed for those critical area trees. So I can see us needing to maybe pull a bit more information if we want to kind of parse out which of these is coming under the shoreline tree permits that we've essentially got proposed and which don't. And I'd like to provide that information more clearly to the council. I'm afraid we might not get to that depth with a narrative before the committee of the whole on March 14th, as we proposed. So that might be one recommendation, is if we're looking to kind of have a better idea of what this really means for fees around tree permits moving forward, that potentially this could remain as it is and move to the budgeting process for 2023, and we could update it then. But these wireless and the zoning verification letter updates could move forward, and we could essentially move with our tree permits as we have them currently.
I think that's fine with me, if that's okay with you all. I think it seems appropriate to address the fees at that time, and at least we've been briefed, and mm-hmm. you'd have enough time to go, you know, to bring back the information that we asked about and not have to rush it for the next committee of the whole. If that's okay with you guys, I see my council members, they're nodding that it's okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the recommendation will be to
move the section 2 forward.
Yeah.
Move section 2 forward.
Okay. And then we'll address the fees through the budgeting process that we'll do.
Or whatever they decide.
Or however you guys want to bring it back.
Right. It's our choice.
Sure.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense, and it will be open to the standard budgeting process that we go through, so there'd be a little bit more time for input there as well. So if that's something that the committee might be comfortable with, to move the wireless and zoning verification letter sections of this resolution forward, we'd be happy to look into the tree permit fees a little bit more.
Sounds good.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The next item on the agenda is an update on the rental housing program. Do we have enough time for all of this?
I was going to say, time check.
Time check.
Usually we try to be done by 1:45 or 1:50 at the very latest.
I know.
Well, you don't have a commute tonight.
What?
You don't have a commute tonight.
We certainly do.
We don't.
She wants
10 minutes each. Yeah, I guess that's a question for
staff,
right?
Let's have our rental housing program update. Let's just try to get through it. Let's just try. If we can't, we can't. Derek, sorry.
All right, we'll try and be brief. Thank you. We're here today to talk to you about the rental housing licensing and inspection program and talk about how we kind of managed to pivot during the pandemic and how we're trying to move back into our more normal ways of going on that. I'm introducing Joseph Mose, who's our newest code enforcement officer. He started in the fall, and he had some time to cross-train with Kia, who's our main rental housing code enforcement officer, before she went on maternity leave. So Joseph's been holding down the fort and doing a great job, and he'd like to just kind of give you an overview of what the rental housing program's up to these days. Take it away, Joseph.
Sweet. Thank you, Nora. Well, good evening, council members. I've heard we're on a time crunch, so I'll try to get briefly through this. For the record, Joseph Mose, newest member to the rental housing team. If I can share my screen, I promise you this would be very brief.
And don't rush it. I'm really excited to hear about this presentation. So please, don't feel like you have to rush.
Could the economic development plan
come back?
Hey, Derek.
So it's fine with me to bring the economic development plan back. I would just want to mention to the committee, your March 21st meeting is already pretty full on the tentative agenda. And in fact, we were hoping to bring Wada Jir back to your March 21st meeting. And so that's all. But we're happy to bring the economic development plan back at a future date if we have to. But I don't need anything out of that item tonight. It's really the opportunity for the committee. So if you didn't have anything you want to talk about, then it would take a minute. It's up to you.
Okay. We'll do the presentation. If there's still time, we'll take it, or we'll provide questions or comments to Derek by email.
Sure.
At least.
Sure.
That would be fine. You could easily do that. You can provide input anytime. So that's all that item was for, is if you want to provide input, that's all.
Thanks so much, Derek. Okay.
All righty. Not able to see. Are you guys able to see the presentation?
We can't see you're not sharing screen yet, I don't think.
Uh, There we go. I think I should do it.
Okay. Yep.
Yep.
I see it now.
All righty. Let's move on forward. So just an overview. I'll just want to introduce more of the background of the rental housing history. We'll get touch base of our rental housing team. Now I wanted to really walk through the rental housing inspection procedures on what we have done, especially adjusting to the COVID. And at the end, we'll touch base on the Tukwila rental highlights. So just for the background, the rental housing system was established back in 2010 and primarily was to protect the public health, safety, and their welfare by ensuring a proper maintenance of rental housing. So doing this, so we've created a system with inspections with our city workers. Most of our codes and regulations could be found in our TMC Chapter 5.06. So introducing to our team, our what I like to call the big three. We have Lori Solberg. She's mainly handling our admin. She's been a wonderful help in scheduling our inspections and just updating all of our rental, and she's done a phenomenal job. We have Kia, who is our senior inspector. Just as Nora said, she took me under her wing, and she's done a great job with mentoring me and teaching me the ropes. All three of us fall under Nora. So here's our team. So as far as for rental housing inspections, each rental property is required a rental license, and it's required annually. So part of that rental license is you need to pay a rental fee, and requires an updated inspection, a rental inspection. Now, for rental housing inspections that have passed either by a city inspector or a private inspector, their rental inspection is good for up to 4 years. Due to COVID, council has approved about 2 years extensions for reinspections. So I know this kind of doesn't make sense, but so for instance, 2018 originally inspections would do 2022, but with the COVID, they have an extension of 2 years. Now for city inspectors can inspect properties up to 4 units. Anything larger than 4 units, we would have private inspectors inspect that property. Now, this isn't just any other private inspector. We have an approved list of private inspectors that is also on the Tukwila page. And, you know, if the property owner asks, you know, what city inspector, we have that information we can provide. So just showing a couple steps on how to renew rental license. Of course, we have virtually online the Tukwila page off on community development to the left, and then rental housing, and then we have a link that is pretty easy and quick to access in regards to trying to renew your license. Now, lately, you know, we're not perfect. We're trying to, you know, we'll have issues with the link here and there, but we do offer emails and over the phone of just, and then recently walk-ins on Mondays and Wednesdays for personnel who wants to renew their license and or also schedule an inspection date. Now, as far as for inspections, this is an example of a rental inspection sheet. I could probably zoom in, but so I just wanted to go over kind of our procedures of how we conduct our rental inspection. So this would be our template as an inspector going into the home, which we also provide a blank copy for either the tenant or the property owner, and just walk through the steps of this is actually, you know, each room, what we look for. If you can see here. All right. If you can see, so for example, for bathrooms, maybe bathroom one, what some type of things we'll inspect for is mold, mildew, any signs of moisture, of leaks, and it goes off of a point system. As you can see to the right here, we have minor, moderate, and severe, all within a point system in which we categorize at the end of our inspection where we total the score. If the total score amounts to 25 points or more, immediately that would require a failed inspection and require a reinspection. Reinspection will need to be scheduled within the next 30 days. So you're probably asking, wondering, you know, before COVID, we had in-house inspections. Recently, we've created a virtual inspection method in which was actually established, I believe, 2021. But a virtual inspection is pretty much the same thing. In this note, we would have a video chat between the tenant or property owner and the inspector. We have a created instruction picture diagram, which pretty much walks through the process of what to do, what to expect, and, you know, making sure we hit all the key points of every dining room, at, you know, inspecting, making sure all checklists has been checked. So what I wanted to point out on this inspection sheet is a hazard checklist. As you can see, we have categories from electrical hazards, inadequate emergency egress. These are things that we categorize as a failure, you know, automatic failure. Whether it's one thing missing or, as you can see, like a smoking detector. These are all things that we find as, you know, critical safety hazards. So it would sum into a automatic failure, and again, with a reinspection within 30 days scheduled. And just another note, I know for some residents, they might seem this inspection might be a harsh method or something, but we take this part very serious, just out of the safety for the public, you know, especially for the tenants. You know, we wouldn't want them to continue on living, you know, with anything hazardous, such as emergency egress being blocked. And here are some Tukwila rental highlights. This was last updated on the 28th of February, but overall, we've had this year 556 rental licenses and about 4,260 rental units. 381 of those units are pending inspection. Because of the extension of COVID, we've having to double pretty much a lot of rental inspections coming near this future. 266 licenses without balance due, amounting to fees of $30,449. So, I put listed here 2019, 2020, 21, 22. These are all fees that have been paid. Now, these are numbers that we feel that is important just to show the progression of where the rental housing system came from. You know, during the first inspection cycle from 2010 to 2014, we've actually had more units fail than we do now. So if someone were to ask us, is the rental housing system effective? And I would say it's 100% effective, you know, being able to improve the living of, you know, of our locals. So that would be the end of that. Council members, do you have any questions?
Council member Haldry?
I don't. I have to check and see if I had a second. I don't think so.
We can go back around to you.
Yeah, I think, thank you for the presentation.
Councilmember Quinn?
I don't have any questions at this time, as we're kind of starting back up. I think that the presentation was very good. So I'm assuming Mr. Say your last name for me.
Oh, it's Mose.
Mr. Mose, this is your first presentation, right?
Yes, sir.
Great job. And I would say the substance of it was really helpful, and I think we went a little deeper than maybe we have before. And for those that forgot about the process that was approved, this is a nice reminder. And I guess what I would say is, I think in transitioning to a contracted inspection process, I think a part of that internally in BCD, they were going to give us a sense of how it's been going with the contractor and if there are any issues related to contracting that component out with, and then, and I guess my other question is, do you see any time in the future, whether it's you or Nora, that we would bring some of this back in-house? So I'm just wondering for those two things.
I can jump in on some of the history on that one. We, most of our the private inspectors are very reputable and licensed and all of that. We have found maybe two bad apples in the course of the history of the program, and we have a process in place to remove them and require reinspections if we feel like they're not doing an adequate job. You know, I think the choice to move to using private inspectors was really based on staff capacity. And so it's a matter of, do we have the capacity to expand that in-house, or is that something that property owners should outsource? And especially for the larger, you know, 100-unit complexes, it's more efficient for them to hire a private company that could just do a sweep in one day versus us that might take us a week to get through. So some of it is convenience for the property owners as well.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. My first is, what are we currently doing to inform our community of this program? Because as I understand it, there is the annual process of renewing the license, doing the inspections every 4 years. But there is also an opportunity for anybody to maybe make a report or report a complaint where you would, you know, come and check it out at that time. And I say this because there was a resident who contacted the council, I believe, last year about, and I don't know if it was just me or if he contacted all of us, about issues that he was experiencing with his landlord, like shutting off the water, and not giving notice to the tenants. And so I think I connected them with Kia. I don't know how that was resolved. But my question is, how are we currently letting our residents here know about the program?
Well, often we get referrals in through either the general code enforcement line, or they come in through human services, where people will come in and have a human services type complaint that it's easier for us to handle, or we're the better people to talk through. I'd say all of our apartment complexes are well aware of the project. Some of our single family renter, you know, landlords don't realize it right away. We get in touch with them as we find that houses have changed hands and have an absentee owner. We can reach out to them that way. You know, as far as the tenants, it's usually when they have an issue and come to the city for help that they're made aware of it.
Would there be, I mean, is there concern, say, if we did ask for information to be provided in like a Hazelnut newsletter, would you guys have any opposition to something like that? Like, would we not be able to handle the capacity if we made it more widely known that this program existed?
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly tell tenants that if they have an issue, they don't have to wait for their 4-year inspection cycle. They can contact the rental housing program. And we have done courtesy inspections for tenants in that case where they feel like their unit isn't being maintained to a health and safety standard. They can give us permission to do an off-time inspection, and we don't charge for that. We do it as a courtesy.
My last question is, what are the biggest challenges that the program is facing? Just like challenges and opportunities. I think it's a great program. Like I know that I've heard from friends working in like the housing field that Tukwila is unique and that we have this program to protect those who are renters here. And so I'm really curious, just what are some of the challenges that you all are facing in implementing the program, and then also just some growth opportunities, if there are some?
I can answer. I've, just because as an inspector, you know, especially as a new inspector, I think the biggest challenge was to, you know, you inspect a tenant's home and maybe there's a lot of things missing that or deficiencies you find, and, you know, it brings them unaware of what is actually going on sometimes, where I run into scenarios where, you know, it is an owner's job and responsibility to, you know, handle this deficiency. So it gives the also leeway, like, hey, you know, the property owner has that right to either continue with the, you know, rental. So I think it's more of a personal challenge for myself just to, you know, witness that.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly just appreciate the work that you're doing and that's being done. And that is really difficult to be in that situation. But I'm just really grateful that we have a program like this that's looking out for the interests, the health, the safety of our tenants, who I think make up the majority of people living here.
Probably, yes.
Okay. In terms of number. So just, you know, do you guys have any more questions? Please do reach out to us and let us know how we could support this program in any way. I think I might have asked for this presentation, or we all did, but thank you so much for coming before us and preparing this, and we look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you, Councilman.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
One thing I do want to say just in regards to this is, so I sit on the Joint Recommendations Committee for King County, and one of the things is in addressing the issue that you brought up, Joseph, like, I'm just wondering if there's even any programs out there that could help landlords if they do run into issues where they, you know, might not be able to pay for some of the fixes that are required. Like, I don't know, are there any programs out there that could assist them, small landlords? It's just something I'm thinking about.
That's definitely something I'll have to look into more. I don't think Tukwila itself has any resources, but I know there are King County other resources that I can definitely look back into.
You.
That was one of the recommendations in the Housing Action Plan, is that we look at, especially for low-income housing, if there's ways to help support that. Funding is very hard to come by in that area, but it was something that we wanted to explore further.
And I think it's in our interest of preservation of affordable housing, and if that can be mitigated by a willing, responsible landlord who may just need a little assistance so that they can continue to offer that. And I know just in general, sometimes it's a trade-off. It may be one that they don't want to make on the tenant. So those considerations for sure.
Yeah. So I'll be thinking about this because I'm also on the SCIP executive board. And I haven't heard of any of these opportunities, but I'll be looking out for us as well as the other regions who are dealing with a lot of these issues too. But yeah, thank you. I know council members probably want some time before our next meeting, although we just have to walk. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was nice to meet you, Joseph.
Thank you all.
All right. The meeting is adjourned.